Welcome to the For Love and Money podcast, the show where business and social purpose meet to inspire a movement for positive change. Here's your host, Carolyn Butler Madden.
Earlier this year, I was part of a panel at Mumbrella ComsCon to discuss how to profit with purpose. I joined three leaders in Australia's communications industry, all women, all movers and shakers, founders and leaders of their communications agencies. The discussion we had was great, but we barely had time to scratch the surface of what is such an important topic within an industry that has such influence and leverage. So I invited them to join me on the podcast to take a deeper dive into the topic. Now, I managed to get two of them into the interview. The third one, Simone Gupta, who is co-founder of a new independent creative agency called Supermassive. She helped us shape the subject, but unfortunately couldn't make the actual interview. So the two guests we do have on the interview are Joanne Painter, who is co-founder and group managing director of Icon Agency, and Dina Vassallo, CEO and founder of Society. Now, let me introduce you first to Joanne. Joanne has over 30 years of experience across media, strategic communications, and public relations. She was recently named 2022 PR Agency Head of the Year in the prestigious Asia Awards. She was formerly a senior journalist with The Age, and she now consults to Icon's government and corporate clients in Australia and across Asia Pacific, including Salesforce, Schneider Electric, ADP, the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, the Department of Defence, AUSTRAC, the Department of Education, and the National Library of Australia. Dina is the CEO and founder of Society, an independent female-led creative agency with a fresh and brave approach to marketing communications. Society puts people at the heart of everything they do and works to support brands and organizations that are positively shaping the societies in which we live, work, and play. Dina lives her values of environmentalism and female representation and empowerment through her work on the board of Green Adelaide and as the chair of She Creates. Now, in this interview, the rabbit hole we go down is, I believe, a really important one: the power of brands to lead positive change within business. But it's actually more than that. This interview is about brands leading societal progress. Our conversation expands to leadership, the risk of inaction, and the need for bravery, and how brands and leaders can move forward with their purpose agenda. It is a really rich conversation with two brilliant women who are driving change through their industry. I hope you really enjoy it. Dina and Joanne, welcome to the For Love and Money podcast.
Thank you very much.
Very excited.
I'm really excited to get into this conversation, but I want to kick off first with the question we ask all our guests is, we all know the role that money plays in business. Does love have a role to play? Joanne, do you want to lead us off?
Look, I think it's a wonderful question. And, you know, I think it's an emphatic yes. And the reason I say that, you know, if you think about a brand is a multitude of elements, but if it's completely rational, you know, love isn't irrational, love is emotional. But if you look at a brand in purely rational terms, it's very reductive, yeah? So it has these attributes and these things. If you look at a brand in emotional terms, you then start to get into that deeper, the deeper layers around purpose, engagement. It's about memorable interactions, it's about meaningful experiences and those lasting impressions. They're things you can't buy. They're not rational, yeah? They're very individual to that person. And together, that's what builds brand salience, which is the fundamental underpinning of business value. So if you've got a brand that people like and admire and want to buy, even if it's more expensive or more difficult to obtain, you're getting very close to love. And that's a beautiful position to be in business. So yes, it does matter.
Oh, I love that response. Yes. Dina, over to you.
A fantastic response. And I think oftentimes one of the things I sort of discovered when I moved to Australia is a lot of brands stayed in a very functional, I'll call it a functional space, where I had come from a market that was high on the emotional side of brand building. And it's very topical what Joanne is saying, that absolutely when you're dealing in a kind of environment where consumers have a lot of choice and are empowered to make those choices, there are a lot of brands or things that do very similar things functionally. And that is not going to separate you from the pack or be a unique value proposition that might get somebody to reach into that pocket of theirs and pull out that hard-earned cash. That emotional connection is the saliency that could be the difference between picking your brand and picking another. The other thing I was going to add is I sense very much so that belonging on a human level is becoming much more valued and much more important. And as a business leader or a business owner or a brand owner, if you can bring love, which will bring connection and belonging with your community who work for you or who might be engaging in your product or service, you are creating a bit of that sense of belonging when we're feeling probably quite distanced in some areas. And building that connection, which probably at the root has love in it, I think there's a lot of purpose and meaning in that. And I also think there's just a lot of goodwill in that, that more and more people want and or need. So if we can lead from that space of love, not only will you have the benefits of the brand building side, but there's also just some good richness in that from a human connection standpoint that I think we all kind of desire and want more from.
That's
brilliant. Can I just add something, one more thing to that? And I give a little example. For me, brand love equals resilience. Yeah. It gives brands the ability to fail and to try again. A good example, a few months, and this is really fun, this is a really functional example. About a year ago, I was doing a renovation, purchased, I've always used E&S Trading, really great, you know, they're great customer service. I had a really bad experience. Yeah, I bought some products, they didn't stand behind their products. And because I do this a lot, I thought, well, I'll take my business elsewhere. Just, you know, I was really unhappy with the brand. Let them know I was really disappointed. They came back to me with a really great response. And in fact, the tech they sent out was great. So I thought this time, just a few weeks ago, renovating the office, I said, I'll just give them one more chance. And the experience I had with that, with the consultant there was brilliant. He went above and beyond phoning me, you know, he said, oh, this product isn't in, so let's find another one. Proactive, attentive, saw that I was a repeat customer and made it known to me that he was going to look after me. So this is a really good example. If you've got a brand that, you know, that a customer is repeatedly engaging with, and they have a good experience and then they have a bad one, the difference about losing that customer is often around the level of emotional or attachment, the totality of their experience with your brand. And nowadays, that's, you know, as Dina was saying, with so much competition, so many contrasting voices, that resilience can be the lifeblood of your brand. So I think there's almost, there's many, many things that are important in brands and businesses, but brand love is one of the most important.
Oh, I'm already loving this conversation around emotions and connection. Like Dina, when you were saying it's belonging is more important, I think one of the things is it's always been important, but now there is permission to expect it in the workplace. And going beyond that as well, you know, the progressive leaders who actually see it's not just about giving permission, it's what if you can create that environment where people feel that belonging, where they're connected to the brand, what it stands for, and want to give their all to it. And to your point, Joanne, it's the I think people don't you think people want to love brands?
Yeah, look, I think some brands definitely they want to love, or at least they want to feel good about. You know, which can kind of follow that same emotional thread in some sort of way. You're going to feel, you know, I was shopping for a new car the other day and you wanted to feel like not only were you getting good service, but that you were selecting a brand that had some good values, had a good reputation, had safety in mind, but still performance. You know, you're looking for lots of things in that kind of environment and trying to make sure that it ended up being something you really loved to drive and use every day was probably the difference between me picking one car versus another car. It ended up being probably more of an emotional decision than anything else.
Yeah. And yeah. I think that's a really great point, Dina, that, you know, with a plethora of choices in front of consumers, You know, brands are so much of an extension of our own personality. So I don't know what car you bought, but, you know, if you live, my brother's Canadian, and they drive these great big trucks, yeah? And they're really big. They're a big identity signaler, yeah? So if you're a particular, you live in a particular area, or you do a particular job, or, you know, you like particular sports, like outdoor things, you'll drive a big four-wheel drive truck, not because you want to be a gas guzzler, because that's your identity. And if you take that back, you bring that back to brand love. Brand love is often, or, you know, the love or attachment or our emotional engagement with brands is often very much linked to our own sense of identity and our own sense of who we want to be seen as.
100%. The stories we tell ourselves about ourselves.
Yeah.
Every purchase we make, or most of the important ones, are a story we're telling ourselves about who we are. Now, we've already got into this, and I haven't even introduced you guys. So, Dina, will you kick off and share your background and, you know, tell us a bit about your agency and why purpose is so important to you?
That's a big question. I feel like I'm going to take the whole show now. No, I won't. So my background is traditionally actually was in advertising. That is what I studied in the US and in the UK. But through that journey, I discovered that I really enjoyed the psychology part of the creative elements of advertising, which actually led me to more of a public relations space where I felt like I could make emotional connections, build reputation, still be quite creative, but bring in sort of behavior psychology on a more one-to-one personal level, which was really attractive to me. So I spent sort of the first decade of my career working for Edelman in New York, and I worked in the consumer brand division. So I was like a consumer brand girl from day one, where I learned all the things around functional versus emotional, worked with some of the, you know, biggest brands in the world that we all know and probably have in our homes. So it was a fantastic training ground. And then I moved to Asia Pacific, moved to Australia, where I worked for the WPP Group in their public relations arm, and did a lot in innovation and integration. I've always been very interested in the idea of brand communications in more of an integrated facet. So it was less about the channel that you used. So advertising, PR, events, digital, to me, it was more about the story you were telling and how you could holistically tell that story through all different kinds of surprise and delight ways, through all different kinds of channels or experiences. So I kind of really leaned into that integrated space. My last role in that group was the chief commercial officer through Asia Pacific. And so I had the opportunity to work with lots of different countries, lots of different people, lots of different brands. And I felt like after having both of all of those experiences, one thing that I actually really felt was missing, being a marketing communications professional, was actually the connection to people and putting people first. I often started to feel like as marketeers, we are very influential in the decisions people make, the decisions governments even make. And I started to wonder if we were taking that as seriously as we should as marketing communicators. And were we really putting people at the heart of those decisions, or were we putting money at the heart of the decisions and the advice that we were giving brands and companies? So when I left, I created a company called Society. And the intent behind Society was that it was going to be a people-first organization that really wanted to work with brands or organizations that were positively influencing how we live, work, or play in society. It's literally how it became called Society. It was just people wrapped into every single component of the DNA of the business. And it was intended to be a creative comms integrated agency, and that is what it is today. And delightfully, we work with wonderful big brands like Woolworths and Optus and Unilever, different government departments. We're really fortunate, but I look to work with organizations that love what they do, take what they do seriously, and equally look to have people work for Society who are really passionate about the craft of marketing communications, understand the influence that they have and use that for good. We have a saying in the business, which is work hard, be kind, and always put people at the heart of everything you do. And if you kind of continue to do everything in that lens, I've found that the business has led itself through that ethos and has continued to snowball and grow on itself because that position resonates with so many people, both from clients, but from potential employees as well. And, you know, and it feels really good. After doing this for 20 years, it feels really good to have a company that is trying to do the right thing, is trying to work with people who are doing the right thing or on the journey to doing the right thing, and haven't forgot about the human connections, haven't forgot about society as a whole. And I think, you know, that's something I get the most joy out of by being the CEO and founder of Society, and something I'm just, you know, looking forward to as we look to even expand into other markets as well.
That's wonderful. And, you know, going back to what we were talking about with your car purchase, and, you know, attracting the people that it's the story people are telling themselves about why they buy a car, why they join this particular agency, you know, and the kind of work they want to do. So it's very much about attracting your people like us and building that movement of positively influencing how we live, work and play in society, which I love that. So thank you, Dina. Joanne, would you like to share your story?
Yeah, well, and it's a very different journey, but we arrived, Dina and I have arrived at very similar places, which is one of the reasons I'm such a fan of her firm. Well, my background, I started in academia and famously did my, was doing my master's and starting a PhD in Russian politics. I studied Chinese politics and then Russian revolutionary revolutionary as an eco-politics and social change in Russia. But then I realized I'd been studying for many years. I was completely broke. And then I was offered a job indirectly then at The Age. So I became a journalist and spent many, many happy years at The Age. But, you know, the whole time I was there, I was always pestering, you know, particularly around this is the sort of start of the desktop publishing and internet revolution, and was just fascinated by online, and they were very slow on the uptake. So my husband, Chris, who was then running his own agency, digital agency, said, come on, our little boy, Sebastian, who's now 24, he'd been born, he was probably about a year old or 2 years old, and I said, all right, let's just do it. I jumped ship, and that's, you know, we've been around now for 20, coming up to our 21st anniversary. But as an agency, that's
amazing in this industry, like that is incredible.
I look back and I think, I mean, there are so many times we perhaps shouldn't have stayed in business, but we've been very fortunate to have a strong business in the right time at the right place. But for us, you know, we've always had a strong ethical base. Chris and I are proud, you know, lefty greeny. You know, we live in a nice home and we drive nice vehicles, but, you know, we have a nice handbag. But, you know, fundamentally, we really do deeply believe in social causes and equity and particularly around sustainability. And so about 4 or 5 years ago, when the business was really starting to grow, we really looked at the work we love doing. And it was always coming back to work that had a social impact or a human impact in some sort of measurable term, whether that's through an environmental lens, through a product lens or other. And we also found when we spoke to our staff, we did a survey and we asked them, what really gets you up in the morning? And the same thing, it was, you know, work that matters. We made a choice. We made a very conscious decision to stop working for the brands that we perhaps didn't really like or that we didn't necessarily feel made the world a better place. And we self-selected brands and organizations, particularly around government, that actually make a positive difference, whether it's, you know, helping aged care, whether it's health, education. We do a lot of work in national security in countering violent extremism. What we started to see was by embracing that and putting purpose at the heart of the business, as Dina said so well, you know, the two follow. We had clients clamoring to work with us because they themselves believe the same things. And, you know, you don't have to be you can be on different sides of the political fence. You can have, you know, people who are strongly pro one thing or the other, but at the heart, it is about people. And it is about doing work that in some positive way makes our world a better place. And then the other consequence, which we're still feeling now, is, you know, we attract brilliant talent and we attract them from other agencies and other businesses. because they want to work on work that matters. And we're evolving our business positioning, which is around work that matters. We want to have a difference every day through our effort. I'm too old to be doing, you know, taking the crappy jobs that ultimately look at and you go, why did I spend the last 2 months working on that? It's meaningless. I want to be looking at work and going, wow. And more and more we are producing work of that caliber. So, yeah, in a pot of history, that's ICON.
Thank you. And, you know, I'm so excited to have the two of you on this show, because brands are so influential. And, you know, there is such an opportunity for brands to lead important change. And, you know, so what you are doing respectively in your businesses and your agencies is so important. And I think the messages you have to share and the way you think about things is going to be really valuable and insightful for our listeners. So we're starting to see a shift globally towards a purpose-led economy. It's happening here in Australia, a little bit slower than in other places, which is a bit frustrating. But, you know, we're going to see that accelerate further. We had another guest on this show just recently who was talking about the accounting standards that are coming in next year, that put ESG as part of the general financial standards. And that's going to accelerate things in a big, big way. And she was making the case, which was really interesting, for CFOs to lead the purpose and ESG agenda. Mm-hmm. Now, traditionally, you know, from the work I do, I see it's usually led by, you know, in the most progressive cases, the CEOs, but usually in bigger companies, HR or brand. So my question to you is, what is your belief? How important do you think it is for brands when it comes to purpose? Why, you know, why is brand leadership so important?
Dina, you start on that one.
There's a couple questions bundled into that. I guess, you know, your last point around, is it important for brands to have the purpose? I suppose to summarize that, and whose role is it? Kind of double barreled. I actually think the more I've been thinking about this and considering this deeply, I don't think it's a one person's role, one person's effort. More and more, I'm thinking it has to almost be a part of every single job description for it to actually be something that creates movement. You can influence from the top down as the CEO, or from the brand side, or even from the CFO, or you can give ambassadors at a junior level a role up and meet in the middle. But how cool would it be if it was actually part of everyone's job description and everybody had a role to play within servicing that brand purpose? I think we'd get there a whole lot faster. I think I'm going to look into that now that I've been thinking about that more. But in terms of, yeah, brands and how important it is to have that purpose. So the ESG standards globally are moving much faster in other aspects than it is in Australia. So all the way through the supply chain. So it will not be good enough for your company just to have its own ESG strategy. Your entire supply chain also needs to have that. And that's probably where the finance comes into it and procurement comes into it, and understanding who is making these decisions, who are you engaging with as part of your company's supply chain, and is the ESG flowing all the way through? Because if you're doing something really great over here, but your supply chain is quite dirty, you haven't probably made as big of an improvement or impact as you would like. And those regulations are coming down fast and thick out of Europe, which we will see it come into Australia. And if Australia wants to meet some of its ESG goals from a global perspective, or even just from our own economic perspective, we won't get there if just the big companies and brands take this on board. We will only get there, we're a country of what, over 80% SMEs, we will only get there if the SME community and the full supply chain embodies and embraces ESG and has the support from government and big business to do that. So if it were me and I was a widget maker in some sort of manufacturing facility somewhere, I would be dialing up my ESG fast and furious because those big companies need me and can only be dealing with me within the next couple of years and bringing that all the way through. And I don't know if that's recognized enough, if I'm really brutally honest. I think you hear it at the bigger end of town. You know, the big four are aware of it and you know, our big retailers are all doing it. I don't know if you really bed it down into the SME framework within this country, how many SMEs had a very strong ESG proposition and were working toward those goals within their supply chain or could fund doing that within their supply chain either. And I would love to know more about that actually in terms of what percentage was doing it. But I think unless there is help from bigger corporate or government, it could possibly be Australia's undoing in terms of meeting our bigger goals, unless we kind of work with that SME. So overall, to summarize, I think it's really critically important, but I think it's within every job and within every single company. And that leadership has to kind of come in from all of those aspects for us to really meet the goals that we need to achieve as a country.
Yeah, and a really interesting point you raise about SMEs and who, the question in my mind then is, who should be leading it? Like who should be leading that side of things? Who should be making SMEs more aware of it? How, you know, how do we get them up to speed? That's a whole other question. I'm not going to ask you to answer it unless you happen to have a thought on that. But
I have one thought bubble on it. Because we just worked on a project with a global company out of Germany who is very big on trying to help SMEs understand the supply chain of their ESG strategies. And they had a product that is basically needed in any type of manufacturing environment to meet some of those initial ESG criteria. And they actually were struggling to pilot that in Australia because they were getting turned back from company and turned back from government. And it took, they finally just got a pilot program off the ground, which we were a part of. That pilot program's actually happening in South Australia with the support of the South Australian government in the food and beverage sector, which is one of their top 9 growth sectors that they're focusing on. But even that felt harder than it should felt. And it did make me wonder, you have this global company that has the technology and the tool. It is very expensive. It took getting government and an industry body on board to create one pilot program, and it was way too long in the making. So it did raise a flag for me that unless we can, it's probably going to come down through global. That's probably going to be the thing that forces the hand. But unless you get the industry body with government to embrace and support it for the smaller company, it will be quite hard. So it's probably a bit of a stool type strategy. I don't know, 3-legged stool, 4-legged stool, maybe it's 10-leg stool. I think it's going to take a lot to get that change happening. And that was kind of a bit of a wake up call for me that this isn't going to actually be easy.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's like mainstream Australia seem to be still in a compliance mindset rather than, you know, recognizing the opportunity that this gives us. So their maturity on purpose and ESG is further down the chain in compliance. But it's interesting because the other thing is we're seeing the progressive brands who are leading and businesses who are leading creating a ruckus, and that's a way to wake up, you know, other businesses. So, Joanne, I want to turn to you and ask you that same question in terms of this, the purpose-led economy that is unfolding. How important do you think are brands when it comes to helping to build that movement?
Look, I think, you know, we often, I think we were talking, Caroline, a few days ago about the sort of the anti-woke capitalism outcry from the right, principally led by the wacky right that, you know, that was so associated with Trump, but nevertheless, you know, very much a mainstream right issue now. And you know, they put brand activism and shareholder activism and activist capitalism into this binary conversation. Yeah, you either are or you're against it. You're either woke and you want to have all these soft and fluffy things attached to businesses' bottom lines, or it's pure unfettered capitalism. The reality is far more nuanced. And what they're really forgetting, the fundamental thing they're forgetting, is at the heart of this, companies shape and are shaped by the society they're part of. And that includes the evolving and changing preferences of shareholders. And by shareholders, I don't just mean people who own shares. I'm talking about the customers, the suppliers, the partners, the providers. That ecosystem is demanding more accountability. They're demanding change. They want a different social contract with capitalism. So, you know, I strongly believe that that conversation around, is purpose-led branding just a woke issue? You know, it's what I'm saying is it is the most fundamental positioning and starting point for every single brand. How far along that journey you want to go, because, you know, the reality is that millennials have recast the conversation around consumer behaviors, around expectations of governance, around the ESG, and particularly the CSR, ESG, of course, being CSR and ESG being quite different disciplines. But, you know, they are looking to interact with and purchase and engage with brands that stand for something, that have meaning in their world. And that can be everything from brands like, you know, I was thinking about, you know, what brands, apart from the obvious ones, you know, do people really love, yeah? Like McDonald's, like eat their products, but people love that brand. It means something to them. You know, in my world, that's not a brand that I would love, but I can recognize and respect that they've earned the loyalty and love of many of their customers. And so, you know, there was a really good, there's a bit of research last year by the Investment Association in the UK, and it was looking at the amount of the companies that now have ESG as a fundamental part of their operational model. It found that 49% of the 9.4 trillion investment funds under UK management are pledged to promote environmental, social cohesion and good governance, in other words, ESG. So 50% pretty much of the major funds under management in the UK are now directly tied to ESG performance metrics. Mm. That's not just a small change. That is a fundamental
massive shift.
And that's in the UK, which has some of the most lax governance. It has, you know, a very free market, freewheeling economy. So, you know, you come to a country like Australia where, you know, we are seeing that, you know, the new accounting standards, we're seeing the ACCC and ASIC. You know, last week we had the Vanguard basically called out for greenwashing. You know, they're signaling a much stronger regulatory environment, a propensity to out the greenwashers and the purpose washers, if you like. So, you know, again, I don't think it's binary. I don't think it's choice one or the other. It's not A or B. It's you know, A and B are fundamentally now part of the reality.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that. This whole profit and purpose is a binary choice. It's lazy thinking.
There is incontrovertible evidence. There's decades now of evidence that show that brands that are prepared to stand up and stand for something, even if they cop flak for it, even if they get it wrong, they are the ones we talked about resilience, brand resilience. They're the ones that are really successful. I think, we were talking earlier about Nike's campaign with Colin Kaepernick during, the peak of Trumpism and the peak of the nasty, nasty sort of reactionary right. They doubled down on that. They stuck with that because it was the right thing to do. And the uplift in their shares, the uplift in their product sales, the uplift in their brand metrics around brand love were off the charts. So if there isn't a great example of, you know, really sticking to what you believe as a brand, and this falls within both the CSR and the ESG dimensions, there is now very strong evidence that, brand have a strong CSR, a strong brand purpose program, and they articulate it well, perform better than ones that don't.
Absolutely.
And I think you see the difference in Bud Light's approach in that they did not.
Dina, can you share, just for our listeners, many will be aware of this, but just give a bit of background into Bud Light?
I'll do my best. I wasn't a part of it, but Bud Light is very, very American type of beer, quite ubiquitous, sort of drunk by everyone, if that makes sense. And they did what was apparently quite a small brand ambassadorship with an influencer by the name of Dylan McIlvaney, I think is how the last name is pronounced. Dylan is a trans woman, so he's a man now, woman, who's been very, very much in the spotlight for day one of a girl, day two of a girl, day three of a girl, followed his whole, her whole transgender transformation story. And Bud Light gifted Dylan, and Dylan did a small little story, I believe it actually was, and it absolutely blew up in Bud Light's and in Dylan's face. And you had Bud Light firing and standing down some of the marketers who were on that campaign. You had them not reach out to Dylan. I believe, last I heard, they still have never actually outreached to Dylan. Dylan had to go into hiding because he was absolutely under attack for what she thought was just cracking a beer and having a sip of a beer that she actually quite liked. Had no support from the brand, no outreach from the brand, had to kind of go offline and down a whole rabbit hole for months, and really impacted her mental health. And it became quite a big thing where Bud Light started getting banned. So you would pass by a store and the Bud Light would just be sitting there, not sold. You'd go to a football or basketball stadium, lines and lines of people to get a drink at the half times or what have you. The Bud Light stands completely, no one daring to even purchase it. And I think that is an example of not backing what you chose to support. They chose to support Dylan. And if they were choosing that for the right reasons and supporting that wider community, then unlike Nike, they did not stand by Dylan. The brand damage continued. And I think what's most heartbreaking about it is Dylan never even heard from the brand, which I feel, as someone who probably just received a gift from a brand and drank it thinking kind of nothing of it, was extremely unfair to be the person sort of crucified for doing that. It's been a really interesting case study. They've tried to then go the other way and put out some really sort of manly ads, which I think just dug the hole deeper for them. It's just a case study of
what not to do.
Air after air after air, off of what my understanding was a really small decision. It wasn't like the Dylan campaign. I think a lot of people thought the Dylan campaign was a really big investment from Bud Light, and it wasn't. It was akin to like influencer gifting. It would have been nothing, and it's now turned into this huge thing that has impacted their brand. But I feel like the story would have been different from Bud Light if they would have just stood by Dylan, stood by that community, because I think what it also shows is that if you're a brand that is going to invest in this community or any community, right, any sort of, person and how they identify, if you're willing to support them, then you shouldn't be willing to walk away from them so easily either. And I think that's the more damaging side of it. If you're a brand that will use something because you think it's to your advantage, but you will back away as soon as you feel threatened by that advantage, that's not an authentic alignment or reason for having that purpose in the first place. So who knows the real story? None of us were actually in it to know exactly what happened, but I think it's a good lesson in what not to do. Like, back something and go, and stay in it, especially when there are people involved. Not backing Dylan when you're the one that started it is really threatening to a lot of people's, humanity in general.
And it's a classic example of purpose washing, isn't it? Because, even if it was a small initiative, a brand, leveraging an influencer for influence and then backing away. And for me, what it shows is I remember watching a video from the brand director, and it was a woman and how she actually wanted to take the brand on a different journey. But what it highlights to me is the disconnect between the brand and the brand team what they want and the business.
Yes.
And that authenticity has to go all the way through. It can't just be a brand team, because that brand team needs the backing of the whole business.
It's also probably an example of the fact that when you are a brand manager or part of a brand team, you are a custodian of that brand. You are not the brand. And some brand managers get that wrong. You know, they want to put their own imprint on it and guide it and lead it. And I actually think the best brand managers and CMOs are the opposite. They recognize that they are the custodians that will be passing it on to the next person. And they are there to be a custodian of the brand, not to be the brand.
Enjoying the podcast? If you're looking for more inspiration, head to our website, thecauseeffect.com.au, for more resources on how you can start using your business as a force for good. Or buy the For Love and Money book. Every copy sold allows us to protect 1 square meter of rainforest. Help us save 10,000 square meters by 2025.
I think what we also see, though, in the Bud Light case is a failure of leadership at the top. You know, Caroline, you asked before about who owns the ESG journey broadly, or who should be responsible. And I was actually chairing a panel today at an ESG forum where this very literal question came up. And you know, there's if you poll recent US polls, identify something like 80 or 90% of people believe it's the leadership, it's the CEO that needs to be seen to be leading. And I think the same would be very equivalent with purpose. And so when you go down that pathway, when you make a conscious choice to embrace a particular community or take on a political viewpoint or associate your brand with a particular social cause, you can't, you know, as Dina said, it's not just the brand team that are responsible for that. That's got to be lived and breathed, and it's got to be held. You've got to hold the line through the entire business, because what, you know, if Bud had done differently, if they had the benefit of hindsight, and actually EO came out the next day and said, guess what? We are for everybody. We believe everybody has the right to drink.
That's leadership.
We welcome every single customer that loves our brand. End of story. They would have won that overnight.
Like Nike did.
Yeah, and it needed the CEO to stand up and get out there on his own social media channels or her own social media channels and literally take back the conversation. But that requires bravery, and it requires vertically integrated decision-making, which clearly wasn't the case, because what you had there was a marketing team doing one thing, and the minute things got a little bit heated, the board and the C-suite ran for the hills, and they left the team exposed. Obviously, the head of brand left. Mm. I believe she was let go. And the damage is enormous.
So we've talked a little bit about the negative and the positive side of it. But Dina, you were telling me how society supported Unilever Australia and New Zealand on communicating their B Corp certification publicly. And, you know, Unilever being one of the biggest household companies in the world, I talk a lot about Unilever, knowing how purpose-driven they are, but they're not perfect. You know, they can't be overnight. It's a journey. But so many people look at me with skepticism, and, you know, because they don't know that. So, you know, I imagine it would have been a very, very tricky piece of work to navigate how you would approach this. So I'd love for you to share some insights on how society actually approached it and what the results were.
It was complicated in that most consumers don't know what B Corp status even means. Even if you put the B Corp logo on, I mean, I think if you're maybe in branding or in business, you're aware of it, but the general grocery market shopper probably doesn't know. So this was a significant deal for Unilever Australia New Zealand to achieve B Corp status. They are the first within Unilever to be able to achieve that for this market. It was a very...
Can you just explain to our listeners, because you've raised a very valid point, that a lot of people still don't know what B Corp certification is.
So B Corp certification is basically a global identifier that your company has done everything to the highest qualities of ESG and DEI standards. So it's more than just sustainability. I think a lot of people think it's just sustainability and you have markers to tick off there, but it's actually also in your governance, it's in your diversity and your equity and your inclusion. It goes all the way through your company and the people who work for you, but also how you manufacture or produce things. It's very stringent. It's not something that you get and you keep forever. It is something that you have to work really hard to achieve, and then you have to work really hard to maintain.
So we've been through it. We are certified, and you know, mine's a micro consultancy, and I can tell you it is difficult. So for an organization like Unilever to do it is breathtaking.
Breathtaking is the way to describe it. Many, many, many years in the making, and you know, Unilever, Australia, New Zealand, I think we should be pretty proud that they were the ones to do it first within the Unilever group. So, you know, they achieved the status. It's very exciting. But how do you make people care about that and not be chest beating about it? So we took a kind of an inverse approach. So instead of just sort of putting out an ad and saying and slapping the B Corp logo on packaging and saying we're B Corp, we took more of an education approach, and we started internally first. We interviewed different people within the Unilever business in Australia, New Zealand, asked them to explain why B Corp mattered to them as an employee for Unilever, shared that through an internal communications rollout. And then from there, then we started talking a bit externally from the C-suite point of view with some other business leaders and with some business media around what it meant for them to achieve it, and really focused just on their CEO at the time, Nikki, kind of doing that media tour with your Sky Newses and your AFRs, explaining it. And then once we kind of got there, we thought, okay, how do we get this to the consumer level now? You know, we've gone internal, the business community is pretty aware of it and applauding it, but how do we take this down to the grocery level, really, where you're shopping for Unilever products? So we decided to create a suite of assets that were digital that would educate people on what B Corp was. And this was actually really difficult because it's not something you can say in like 30 seconds. So we kind of came up with an insight that because of B Corp, Unilever is doing all of these things, and because was sort of our spark way in saying, because it's also the right thing to do. You know, because of this standard of B Corp, Unilever is now doing this. Because of this standard of B Corp, Unilever is now doing this. All because it's the right thing to do, and took a real kind of playful journey. We used a series of animation, really colorful, to get that out there. And it obviously hit the nail on the head, because the Alan Jopp, the CEO of Unilever globally at the time, shared it on his own personal channel, all of our assets, saying, this is what Unilever Australia New Zealand was able to accomplish. So we knew we had the comms right, because if he felt comfortable to share that globally,
amazing.
We had really been able to distill the message in a way that was easy for people to understand. And then once we got to that point, we could see the conversation happening on social a bit more. That's when we decided actually to create a 30-second digital ad that then really kind of brought all of it together. And the challenge here is it's a lot of the products have their own, obviously, brand identity and brand markers. And some of them have never sat together in an ad before. So it was actually quite complicated to tell that story and bring those brands together. But we decided that we couldn't just do it in any regular way. We decided the entire campaign needed to have no carbon footprint in anything that we did either. So when we created this ad, it followed Ad Green standards, which are UK standards for production of advertising to have net zero emissions and to be fully diversity, equity, inclusion in its production model. It has really strong criteria, like 50% of the production team must be female. It goes on and on and on. So we not only put together a 30-second spot, which was very hard to write the copy for, to include all of these brands and explain B Corp status, but we decided to, you know, let's make it harder on ourselves and do it to an Ad Green standard as well, and meet that stringent criteria and make sure that if we did have any carbons, that we offset it at the end of that production. Then we chose wherever we placed it needed to be on a very green digital platform as well, or we would buy offsets. So the whole thing was all the way through, we tried to minimize our carbon footprint with the production of any of the work that we did on this campaign. And then that ad went out on the East Coast and it ran for about 8 weeks, was, you know, really successful, really resonated and explained things to people. And I feel like that first phase, this was just the first phase of Unilever announcing their B Corp status. Whilst it was about a 6-month journey, I think it laid the foundation so that as they move into the next phase of B Corp, which is starting to put the B Corp logo on more of their packaging and things like that, that then we'll be ready for that next phase of telling more people and explaining it at shelf even deeper. So it's been really cool and actually just amazing to see that they've been able to achieve it. And we've learned so much. And even really inspired by the Ad Green standards that now when we do productions, you know, we are looking to have people with disability on site or within casting as well. We're looking to include First Nations point of view in the copywriting to the production. Luckily, society is very female led, so we kind of got that part of it pretty easily. But it's a challenge, and you kind of don't realize, even as creative comms industry, just how much emissions we have ourselves until you start trying to calculate it while you're doing a campaign. And then you go, holy smokes, actually, for us to actually do all of this properly, it takes effort as well. And it's probably something agencies also start to need to look at a little bit more, is how do we reduce our own footprint when we are producing work.
And that's a great story. Thank you so much for sharing it with us. There are a couple of things that pop out to me. One, you know, that you started within Unilever. Mm-hmm. And you know, and I think that's the beating heart of where purpose lives and where this sort of activity lives. So, you know, I love
and your approach. And we knew too, if you worked for Unilever and you were having family dinner on a Sunday night and somebody asked them, what is B Corp? We wanted them to be able to be comfortable to answer what that is. You know, they have thousands of employees in Australia, New Zealand. So it was perfect to arm them with the, when my friends and family ask, I will know what to say.
Yeah, 100%. And the other point that, you know, as you're talking about how you went about things and advertising with carbon net zero advertising and diversity measures, purpose drives innovation more than any other thing I have ever seen, you know, because you are forced to look at doing things in a different way. And that can only be good when we are trying to progress on certain measures. So thank you for sharing that. And what a positive story. And, you know, for Australians and New Zealanders, yeah, we should be proud that this has started here in Australia with Unilever. That's amazing. So, Joanna, I'd love to turn to you and ask you, you know, we've talked about the purpose washing, we've talked about some of the bad things, we've talked about some of the good things, but there is still fear from brand leaders. We've talked about it. I've seen it, you know, I talk to others about it, and there's fear about putting your head above the parapet. Yeah. and leading. So, you know, what do you, I'd love you to kick off and then Dina to jump in, you know, what do you want to tell brand leaders? If you had someone like that who wants to do something but is held back because of fear of the criticism they're going to get, what would you say to them?
Yeah, and it's a really good, I do think that fear is the great the enemy of innovation and progressive enhancement of businesses. I think, you know, you put it in marketers' terms. I would be saying to them, and I have said to marketers that we work with, you know, marketers are all about the data. Yeah, data is fundamental to them, but also so is research. So I'd be saying, you know, look at, talk to your customers, do your qualitative research. Listen to what they're talking about. What do they want? What drives them? What motivates them? What generates brand love? Then do your data insights. So, you know, where are the customers? Where do they live? What are their shopping behaviors? What are their digital behaviors? Because, you know, nowadays the vast majority of transactions and purchases are mediated through a digital lens. If you can deeply understand through qual and quant, so heart, head and heart, to get the data to really make a meaningful decision, you're in a much stronger position to then mitigate and manage the risk. Because, you know, for me, the key thing that you know, we hear all the time is, well, we'd love to do this. We know it's the right thing to do, but I've got legal and compliance telling me, well, we can't say anything or do anything, or we can't stand up for the voice, because that will mean that we've got three customers in Far East Queensland or Far North Queensland that might get, you know, on the blower and talk to the CEO, and he's not going to, or she's not going to like it. So I think that you've got to go in armed with the data and the research and a business case that says, if we go down this path by embracing purpose, by, you know, whether it's CSR, whether it's, you know, introducing and really building an ESG focus and culture within a business, that's all about change. So this is a change management challenge. Change management needs people, it needs data, it needs insights. But also, if I, you know, go back to the previous comment I made, it needs leadership. And so I do think that, you know, the people who have to lead this within an organization have to be the people with their hands on the levers. So whether that is the entire executive team, whether it's CEO and they are the champion of it, or whether it is a collective team that's formed within an organization. In our own business, we have a sustainability and social change team. They're the ones who drive our CSR and ESG agenda. And they come to us as the executive leadership team with recommendations, but they come to us with the knowledge that we've empowered them to make decisions. So unless it's something that is going to be catastrophically damaging to the business, I can't imagine what, maybe they want us to go live in tents or something, we're probably going to say yes. Because they understand that the leadership is embracing the journey. We led the journey. Now we're handing it over to our next generation. And I think the last point about that is really understand where the blockers are. And in organizations, we mentioned, you know, who owns the ESG journey. In many large corporations, it's legal counsel or it's the CFO. Both are very, very risk averse. Legal will typically do, you know, they typically will be running from risk as opposed to embracing it. And this is all about being comfortable with risk, because change involves risk. So empowering your team to manage and mitigate that risk, putting forward the arguments, getting the people you need at the top of the organization, and educating and bringing on board the potential blockers. Because just because you're a lawyer or a CFO doesn't mean you're a bad person. It means your job is designed to reduce and manage the risk to the business or to optimize the financial performance. So those conversations need to be had in a particular way that brings them on the journey and that doesn't get the project mired in, you know, legal and risk compliance or CFO going, well, we can't afford to do it this year, we'll do it in 5 years.
Thank you. That's great. So leadership, empowerment, understand where the blockers are and educate them.
And data.
Data
and research. Qual and quant, head and heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The better you know that, the better you know your customers. But then think forward. Yeah, we only know our customers today. That's going to give us a snapshot of today. What we do know is all of the demographic research about the rise of Gen X and Gen Z and you know, the generations after them is telling us they're fundamentally different generations, and they are demanding change at pace and scale that the old generation of marketers probably, well, we know they're not that comfortable with.
I think those are all, yeah, critical points. I think you have to have all of those. That's great. I suppose my hope is that there's very little risk tied to it because the risk of not doing it is greater. And absolutely, I actually think that tipping point is closer than we think it is, because going back to the love for money, the money will start to tip that over, that if they cannot get contracts from their, you know, from suppliers or sales, because, you know, consumer behavior is changing drastically in terms of wanting to align with brands that are for good, the money will tip the scale, and the risk will actually be, if you don't do it, not only then do you have a much bigger problem on your hand. So that being said, you know, everything that Joanne said is absolutely critical. I do hope that, you know, starts to tip over a bit, but there is something I suppose in small bravery and small wins. You don't necessarily have to go scare your stakeholders, your CFO or your CEO with something extreme. I think maybe taking that Unilever example, start internally first. Can we just run a program for our employees that, you know, has a bit of a diversity and equity lens on it, or has a bit of a CSR lens on it, or a bit of a sustainability lens with how we're recycling in the office? You know, start internally and then share some of those stories, and then start to look at that next layer out. Because if we really think about our target audiences, they're not linear, and they're not just 1, 2, 3, 4. It's a bit of a bullseye. It starts and it ripples out. So start internally in your organization and then go to the next ripple of the next most closely aligned target audience or stakeholder group you have, and then the next ripple, and then the next ripple, and the next ripple. Don't try and hit the whole bullseye all at once. I think that'd be impossible to achieve anyway. So, you know, small wins take the day, and small bravery, I think is a great way. And also starting to think about the risk of not doing it. That is knocking on your door.
I'd go a step further. I think we've passed the point where, you know, consumers, you know, if you don't start very, it's either now or almost, you know, you're going to miss out. That fulcrum point, I think we passed in the last sort of year or two, potentially right. Over COVID, actually. Mm. I think it was, you know, there's been some fundamental shifts in all of our lives, whether it's work, you know, work-life balance, whether it's the way in which we engage as consumers, the fact that we have seen an explosion of conscious consumerism out of COVID. You know, I think that we are in an epoch change, if you like.
That's a great way of putting it.
And also the way we shop is so different, and probably, again, driven a bit by COVID. Online shopping has exploded even more. No longer do you head overseas and go, oh, great, I'm going to bring an empty suitcase and stock up on cool stuff that I can't get in Australia. You can get it all, and it'll be at your door within like 5 days. Mm-hmm. So now not only are Australian brands and businesses competing with Australian brands and businesses, but you're competing for those online dollars that can come from anywhere. And so, if you know, that's probably the other thing to be considering, is it's so easy to go, oh, these pair of jeans or these pair of jeans. Oh, these jeans actually have a better sustainability story to them, and I can get them in 5 days instead of just around the corner. And it's better, you know, it's going to be better for me, better for the environment. They're doing great CSR things, whatever it might be. If you're telling those stories online, the global reach of that is vast, and you know, you're competing with all of that too.
I knew this was going to be a great conversation. Dina and Joanne, thank you. We are out of time, but I want to thank you for coming on and sharing your insights. It's been a really good discussion to have. Any closing thoughts?
I mean, I guess, you know, to wrap it up, my advice, you know, to brands and to, you know, individuals too, if they're looking to go down, you know, whether they're working in the space, whether they really want to pivot their business. You know, we've mentioned the word bravery a number of times. It is around, you know, it is around being brave and understanding that the sea change is happening around you, that it is okay to do good. In fact, you know what, it's a pretty good feeling when, you know, you're working on a project or you're advising a client or something great comes out of it, you go, hey, I've had a great day at work because we actually, you know, we managed to change somebody's life or managed to do something really good. You know, they're not bad things. They're not small things. That's what in this world of, you know, wars and unprecedented threats and insecurity and global boiling, you know, we all have an individual responsibility and a collective opportunity to make a change. And I think that's what purpose-led branding is all about.
You said the exact thing that I was just thinking of. I was like, gosh, well, it just feels good, right?
Yeah.
Don't you want to do things that just feel good? It just feels better. So, you know, I think that alone, which sounds so simplistic when it boils it down, but I was like, it just feels good. So, you know, I think if there's any takeaway, it's, you know, look to make the choices that are kind for people and planet, that make you feel good, even if they're small. And you know, enjoy that journey because it just feels better.
Brilliant. I will include the how to get in touch with each of you for anyone who wants to take the conversation further. Yeah. But thank you so much for giving your time and joining us on the For Love and Money podcast.
Thank you. Pleasure, Caroline.
So good.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the For Love and Money podcast. If you'd like to take a deeper dive into the purpose movement, visit us at thecauseeffect.com.au. And remember, doing good is good for business. So if you're not doing good, then what are you doing?